jump into Exodus. Lord, thank you for today, for the opportunity to be together. Thank you for your hand that guides us, that leads us, that knows what's best for us and takes us in the way that you desire us to go. And I pray that you'd help us to recognize that what you're doing is part of your plan. Where we are is exactly where you want us. And I pray that we would respond in a way to your work in our lives that glorifies you and not that questions or doubts or has concerns. Lord, thank you for the opportunity to look at your word. Thank you for the truth we find there and for the way that we can be changed as we submit ourselves to your truth. I pray that you would work in each one of us this morning as we are confronted with your word. We ask this in your name. Amen. All right, we are in Exodus chapter 13. We started this last time I taught, which was 2 weeks ago. Wasn't here last week because the doctor said take, 48 to 72 hours to get over the surgery stuff. And it's healing up good. I do have my little Jewish yarmulke on. It's just so that Ron doesn't get sick as he looks at my scar, because I'll be sitting right in front of him. But it's healing up good. Cancer's all gone, so that's great news. No other treatment necessary. So,
Friar Brian.
Yeah, I got my tonsure going up here. Actually, if you see me face the west wall here and start rocking back and forth, it's just practicing for Israel. So, I'm not going to do that. So we started this last time, and as the people got out of Egypt, Israel got out of Egypt, that's what Exodus 13 and following really take place of. If you look at the notes, there are new notes either back on that chair back there or that chair back there, which really for the next five chapters, from chapter 13 through chapter 18, really it is the journey from Egypt to Sinai. That's what these chapters really consist of. And so as we get to 13, what they're doing is they're coming out of Egypt and getting ready to get to Sinai. But God's got some stuff to do for them and with them still. He's not finished yet with them, even in this exodus of Egypt. So this is the actual exodus, if you will. It's where they leave Egypt. The first thing they do, we talked about a couple weeks ago, is they consecrate the firstborn. So it's the consecration of the firstborn. And what that's all about is not necessarily just the idea of order, birth order. Firstborn has so much more with it than birth order. It's interesting, in fact, to me that if you consider Israel, back in chapter 5, God had said to Moses, Israel is my firstborn. And that if Pharaoh, because Pharaoh wouldn't let the people go, that he would eventually Pharaoh's firstborn. That keeps going in and out. But I find interesting is really Israel, Jacob, isn't even Isaac's firstborn. He's Isaac's secondborn in birth order. And he's not even the firstborn of a firstborn, because Isaac isn't Abraham's firstborn. Remember, Ishmael is Abraham's firstborn. So there's much more significance to this idea of firstborn than there is just birth order. Firstborn has the idea of all the rights of a firstborn, all the position of a firstborn. It's more of a positional statement than it is a numerical statement. And so what God is saying about Israel is his firstborn. It is the most important, the one worth or gets double blessing, those kinds of things. And so when God asks Israel to consecrate the firstborn, he's asking for the firstborn of the firstborn, because he said, Israel is my firstborn, and now I want the firstborn of the firstborn. And he lays title to that already. He already owns that, right? I mean, the firstborn of Israel, who is Israel anyway? They're God's nation. And so the firstborn of Israel really are already his. So there's, in this consecration, there's this special remembrance of what God did in Israel, in Egypt, for Israel, to get them out. That really is so the consecration of the firstborn is another one of those things that God does to cause Israel to remember the work that he has accomplished. That's why the firstborn is consecrated. That's what's going on here. Because what's supposed to happen is throughout every generation, as the firstborn was consecrated, whether it's a firstborn of a child or firstborn of of an animal. We'll talk about the donkey thing later, but whatever it is, that firstborn is a reminder of what God did as he pulled them out of Egypt because of the death the plague of the death of the firstborn, how he spared Israel's firstborn in that last plague. And so there's this continual, and God does that over and over and over so that Israel could remember what he had done and who he is. You'll see a few times in the Pentateuch where God says you'll bind them as around your wrists and as frontlets on your forehead. And what he's saying to them is these are going to be, when you work, when you do stuff, they're going to be here. It's going to push you to do the things that I call you to do. It's going to be something you think about all the time. That's what he's saying. Now, we know that the Jews, especially the Pharisees, took this very literally and actually made themselves phylacteries and put references. Actually, Exodus 13 is one of the things they stick in their phylactery. That because they're doing exactly what God said, is binding it on their wrists and binding it on their forehead, and they're carrying these verses around with them when they go. If you've ever seen, Ron actually has some. I should have had him bring his phylacteries and wear them this morning. If you've ever seen the Jews dressed in their shawls, and they have these black things around their wrists with little boxes on them, and a black thing on their forehead with a little box on it, that's actually they're taking literal what God's going to tell them to do, to bind it on their wrists and on their forehead. And those are and one of the passages they use is a passage here in Exodus chapter 13, because they're told to bind it. That's not what he meant. He didn't mean to literally bind them. He meant that this should be something that throughout all generations drives you to obey, drives you to meditate on who I am and to obey. He's doing that with this. He does that with the Passover. He does that with unleavened bread. He does that with, remember when the people are going to go into the land in Joshua's day, when Joshua's leading now, they're going to cross the Jordan River in flood stage, and they're going to cross on dry ground. Joshua says to the people, one person from each tribe is supposed to pick up a big rock, a stone, and they get on the other side and they build an altar with that stone. That altar is not built so that they can come and worship or offer sacrifice there. That altar is built so that when you're an Israelite and you're walking around Israel with your son and you pass that altar and your son says, "What is that?" You say, "This is how God brought us into the land miraculously." So God does that over and over and over again to give them these ideas or memories of what he had done for them. And so that's the importance of even this consecration of the firstborn. Because it's a reminder that God had done great things for them as he got them out of Egypt. And so the first thing he does is he gives it tells them to consecrate the firstborn. And this is not an idea of sacrifice the firstborn. It's not where you kill your firstborn child and throw him in the fire. That's going on. People are doing that, but that's not what God's calling Israel to do. God's calling Israel to redeem the firstborn. And as we get into the law, the actual price for the firstborn, we'll get to that. So it's clearly God is not saying, "I want you to take your firstborn and throw them into the fire and give them to me that way." That's not what he's saying to them. He is saying, "I want you to buy your firstborn back." And there's a price. There's a firstborn price we'll get to as we get into the law. We're not going to talk about that today. So that's the importance of the consecration of the firstborn. He then moves, and it seems disjointed here. It seems like, if you read the text, it seems like he does first two verses, consecration of the firstborn, and then he goes to instruction on unleavened bread. If you look at verses 3 through 10, he goes to unleavened bread. Right? Let's just read. He says, "Then Moses said to the people, 'Remember this day in which you came out from Egypt, out of the house of slavery, for by a strong hand the Lord brought you from this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. Today in the month of Abib you are going out. When the Lord brings you into the land of Canaanites, Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you'll eat unleavened bread. On the seventh day you shall eat the feast of the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen with you, and no leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory.'" So he goes from this consecration of the firstborn. He stops, goes to unleavened bread, but look what happens in verse 11. Verse 11. "When the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and shall give it to you, you shall set apart the Lord all the first that opens the womb, all the firstborn of your animals, that our males shall be the Lord's. And so he goes back to the consecration of the firstborn. So why did he throw unleavened bread in the middle of the consecration of the firstborn? Well, I think what he's doing here is he's establishing those things that will be a continual remembrance of what he's done. And so how do they need to remember? Well, he's already told them about Passover. He's already instituted the perpetual keeping of Passover. He's already instituted that for them, right? And as they're getting out now, as they get out of the land, the first thing he asks them is to consecrate the firstborn, okay? That's the now section of the consecration of the firstborn. He's asking them to do that now because of what he had done for them in Egypt, because he had spared their firstborn. He asks them to consecrate the firstborn now. So let's think about this. They celebrated Passover now, and then they got instructions to do Passover in the land. They celebrated unleavened bread then, and they got instructions to celebrate unleavened bread in the land. They consecrated firstborn now, and now they get the instructions for consecration of firstborn when they get into the land. So it's not a bad thought process. He's walking them through those things that they are given to remember what he's done for them, and he's given them instructions about how that is supposed to be done. That's why he's so specific with regard to unleavened bread here. How many days were they supposed to have no leaven around? 7 days. The last day was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They were supposed to celebrate that feast. There would be no leaven for 7 days. And it's all a point back to what he did to get them out of Egypt. It's interesting that oftentimes when you see the Egypt, what Egypt symbolizes is somehow sin. And leaven also symbolizes sin. So as they eradicate leaven and they're coming out of Egypt, there's both the idea of a removal from the bondage of Egypt and sin, which are both Egypt and leaven are a picture of that. Go ahead, Ron. Right. Yeah. So, and again, he is on the theme of consecration and doing it correctly and how that works. So, but I also think this is still a looking at how do you remember what God has done? And he's giving them these things. The first three things are really important. He gives them Passover, unleavened bread, consecration of the firstborn as a direct reminder of him pulling them out of Egypt, him bringing them out of Egypt to accomplish what he's going to do. So we have the instruction for unleavened bread. And then as you go, you have the second section on consecration of the firstborn. And in this, he gets very specific. He gets very specific. What the consecration of the firstborn is about is consecration of firstborn males. And it consists of not just men or not just firstborn babies, humans, it also consists of animals, firstborn animals. He says, when the Lord brings you into the land of Israel, verse 11, the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, he shall give it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb, all the firstborn of your animals that are males shall be the Lord's. Every firstborn of a donkey, though, you shall redeem with a lamb. If you don't redeem it, you shall break its neck. What's the deal with a donkey? God doesn't like donkeys? What's going on? Well, if you consider what is being talked about here, what he's talking about are those herd kind animals, the animals that they would keep, right? The animals they would keep. They would keep as animals for themselves. They would keep sheep, goats, cattle, and donkeys, right? The only one of those that are listed there that's unclean, or will be considered unclean, is a donkey. Donkeys are unclean. All the others are clean animals. So when you sacrifice them or when you redeem them, and the idea I think here is the redemption of the firstborn is where you give them to the priests that are going to be named later. What did the priests do with animals that were offered as sacrifice? They ate them. That was how they got meat. There was a portion of that sacrifice that was given. So So if you were to give, if a Jewish was to person was to come and redeem their firstborn male donkey, it would be sacrificed purposely because it couldn't be eaten. See, God's not about just killing a bunch of animals. That's really, if you consider the sacrificial system, which we will eventually, that's how the priests were provided for. The priests could not own land. They couldn't have their own crops. They couldn't do that. They couldn't have their own herds and stuff. So the way they were provided for was through the sacrificial system. That's how they got grain. That's how they got meat. That's how they got what they were supposed to get. And so if they were to bring them a bunch of donkeys, they wouldn't be able to eat the donkeys because the donkeys are unclean animals. So the donkeys were redeemed a different way. The donkeys were redeemed with a sheep for in their place. And so that's what's going on with the donkey there. If you consider all the other herd animals that they have. Now, so why doesn't he talk about redeeming rabbits? Because rabbits are unclean, right? Well, most Jews didn't herd rabbits. You know, it wasn't, come on, yeehaw! You know, he doesn't do that. Why doesn't he talk about, it's the things that they would keep as herd animals. That's what's being talked about, that they would own that way. Why didn't he talk about dogs? Why don't you talk about dogs? Because the idea of a dog as a pet is a radically new concept. It's not, you didn't, in the Bible times, dogs were scavenger animals. They cleaned up junk. They weren't nice. You didn't keep necessarily dogs as your pet. And why didn't you talk about cats? Because, well, cats are sin, basically. I did that for Ron. You know, cats are good in Chinese food, but that's about all. Anyhow, so that's the idea. Yeah, Dave.
Question here. When it says set aside the firstborn, is it saying the firstborn, but only if it's male, or always the firstborn male, even if it's not really first?
That's good. It's always the firstborn male. Always the firstborn. Yep, go ahead, Ron. Right.
And in the case, for instance, of Abraham, the heir was not just the first out of the womb, it was the first out of the womb of the principal wife.
Right. And yeah.
So it would be Sarah in the case of Abraham, and that's why Ishmael was not the first.
Right.
The firstborn in that sense.
Right.
So, and since females.
So Dave asked a good question. The idea was, so it says here the first to open the womb. What if the first to open the womb was a girl? Does that mean they don't have to redeem that firstborn? I don't believe that's the case. I think the idea is, and I think I'll make that case here this way. When you get into Numbers, when we get there, God's going to ask them to number the firstborn male of all of Israel. And they're going to count that up. It's going to be 22,100, somewhere around there. And then he's going to ask them to count that are 20 years and older. Okay, that's what he asked for. Then he's going to ask them to count the Levites, all the tribe of Levi who are 20 years old and 20 years old and older, all the males, male Levites. And guess how many that is? It's like 22,300. So God says, okay, I'm going to trade you. I'm going to trade you the Levites. I'm going to take the Levites and give you your firstborn. That's how I'm going to take it. But you owe me. You owe me because there's, maybe I got that backwards, it's in my head. There's not enough firstborn to cover all the Levites, or there's not enough Levites to cover all the firstborn, so I'm going to take some of the firstborn price, and you're going to have to give that to me as well. But what's counted are firstborn males, not firstborn everything. And so we need to understand that God's not saying women aren't important. That's not what's going on here. What he is saying, though, that with regard, especially in that time, where the continuing legacy of a family stayed with was with the firstborn son, and that firstborn son had rights, extra rights, more rights. So that is the full consecration. The first one, again, it wasn't about killing them. It wasn't about throwing them into a fire. That's not whatever was supposed to be done with the firstborn. They are supposed to be redeemed, which means to be bought back. And there is going to be a firstborn price. We'll talk about that as we get into the law itself. And we'll talk about the firstborn price. There is a price for the firstborn. Yeah, Chris.
Is there a difference between the firstborn male and the woman, or the firstborn that opened the womb?
That's what Dave was asking. And I think that so if you track the history of Israel, they understood this to mean the firstborn male. That the firstborn male was redeemed. Okay, whether he was actually the firstborn from the womb or not. So letting them understand or taking what they understood this to mean and what they did throughout continual generations, that helps us understand what was meant here in the text and what Moses is talking about, I think. And so what they understood it to mean was firstborn males. That's what they understood it to mean, okay? Because the firstborn male was redeemed. And the firstborn male had the position and the rights of firstborn. The firstborn female doesn't get that. And so there had to be that passing on of those rights from father to firstborn son. Okay, so there is significant, so I think that helps us answer that question as far as what does it mean when he says all that opened the womb. Is that talking about, so if I'm a guy and I have a daughter first, or I have three daughters and then I have a son, I'm not responsible to redeem that firstborn son? I believe, yes, you are responsible to redeem that firstborn son. God thinks you're responsible to redeem that firstborn son. Israel was felt responsible to redeem that firstborn son, even though he was the third one or fourth one born. They were still felt responsibility to redeem that firstborn son. So they understood it to mean that. If that's what they understood it to mean and they're the closest to hearing it, we'll go with what they thought. We'll go with that. I think that helps us a lot understand what he's saying here. It's a very good question. It's a very good question. But based on history and how they understood what it meant, that's how we would how I would interpret that. Maybe they got it wrong. Maybe they got it wrong. But throughout their generations, they consecrated the firstborn son over and over and over again. So, okay. Any other questions about that? So we've got the consecration of the firstborn. We've got instructions for unleavened bread. Letter C is God leads Israel. Now we're going to get into the land, and God is going to actually start to lead them, not just as in a spiritual sense where there's like a feeling of, or I got a real peace about this. I just really feel like this. That's not what they're getting. Moses isn't getting a peace about anything. God is going to actually lead Israel in a very specific way, in a very clear way, telling them where he wants them to go and what he wants them to do, and he's going to do that with in two ways. First of all, he leads them away from the Philistines. 13:17, the text tells us, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And as the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt, equipped for battle. So want to get through this. So here's the deal. The shortest way, the quickest way, the most direct way for them to get from Egypt to Canaan would have been to go straight up to the north, and then straight up to through the land of Philistines, right to Canaan. Would have been about a 3-week journey. Is what it would have been estimated at. For 2 million people to walk that far right at 3 weeks. That would have been the most direct route. But God says, I'm not going to take them that way. I'm not taking that way for a reason. Because I don't want them to get that way and see war. And it's not just, you know, stand on a hill and watch the Philistines fight each other. That's not the idea here. The idea is experience war. Have war with the Philistines. And what do we know about them? Well, they're a strong nation. They're very powerful. Remember that guy named Goliath? He's a Philistine. They're giants. And there were, in that day, There were giants in land. We know that even over in Kadesh Barnea, as they're getting ready to go up and go in, there are giants over there. Well, there are giants here. The Philistines were even giants to the giants. So these are really strong people. And so God says, lest they go that way and see war, which is experience war, have war with Philistines, and they see what's coming at them, and they turn around and run back, and make a plan. You see, if they had gone by the way of Philistines, it's easy to get to Israel or to Canaan that way. Where would it be easier to get back to that way? Back to Egypt. Does God know his people? Yes, he does. Because not only is it's not just seeing war that causes them to want to go back. Get used to this statement. Moses, why did you bring us into this wilderness to die? We should go back to Egypt. Get used to hearing that. You're going to hear that over and over and over again. So what then stops them as they're down by Mount Sinai? What stops them from going back to Egypt? Maybe the Red Sea. Maybe the thing they crossed on dry ground stops them because it's really hard to get back to Egypt at that point. So that's what's going on. It would have been really easy if God had taken them through the way of the Philistines, and they saw what they were coming up against, and then saw how strong the Philistines were. The response, God knew what they would do, is they would run away and head back to the south and head back to Egypt. And it would have been easy for them to do that. There'd have been nothing in their way stopping them from doing that. By leading them south, the way he's going to lead them, by leading them down to Sinai, leading them that way, then it makes it really hard for them to go back. They can talk about it all they want to, but it's really difficult. In fact, not only do they talk about it, it's not even down by Sinai the first time they talk about it. It's right after they cross the Red Sea. Right after they cross the Red Sea, the sea's closed up. They've seen these things. Moses is singing a song. Miriam's singing a song. Life is great for Israel. They come up and they're thirsty. They have nothing to drink. They're parched. Bitter waters are there. And what do they do immediately? Moses, what'd you bring us out here to do? To die? We should go back to Egypt. Okay, Red Sea there. Can't get back there right now. I guess we can't do that. So it was harder for them to get back, and so they had to continue to press on. So he leads them away from the Philistines. But it's interesting how he's leading them or how they're acting now. It says here that they come out of Egypt, from the land of Egypt, equipped for battle. What does that mean? What does that mean, equipped for battle? It's talking about how they're ranked. They're ranked as soldiers. They're ranked like in soldier ranks. And in fact, some of the commentaries I read talked about how they were walking as if they were in military ranks, ready for battle. And it's interesting that why did he not take them to the Philistines in case they see war, but he leads them out of Egypt equipped for battle. It's an interesting contrast there for as I read that. It's interesting to me, but it's how they walk. And I think it's also important to recognize that these weren't, while their primary focus in Egypt was brick making, they're at least, I think, during some of the plague, that time of the plagues, we don't know how long that was. You know, when we read it in the five chapters of Exodus that we read the plagues, it seems like it's back to back to back to back to back. I don't know that it was back to back to back to back to back. I think that if you look at the plagues and how they came, there has to be some kind of distance between some of those plagues, because if you have livestock dying, and then the next plague is livestock getting boils, where'd that livestock come from? If the livestock is dead, and then the livestock get, where'd that come from? Well, I think there has to be some understanding of a passage of time going on there. And remember, we suggested how Pharaoh might have gotten his livestock replenished. He probably went out and bought it. But still getting it there and having it there, there's an indication of a passage of time there. So we don't know how long the plagues took. And I have no idea where I was going with that. It just skipped out of my head where I was even at with that statement. What was I talking about? Anybody remember? Because it's got... See, I got this hole in my head, and sometimes stuff just skips right out of there now because it's not completely closed up, and so it just scoots out. Yeah, Dave, thank you. Oh, thank you very much. So in that time, Moses knows they're going to be leaving, right? And Moses has grown up in Pharaoh's palace, right? Moses was likely very much trained in war. And so as he knows what's going on, he knows where they're going, he knows they're going to go into a land that's already occupied. I'm confident that there was some military training going on. Here's why I'm confident, not because I just think it's the right thing to do, but because when they left Egypt, they left equipped for battle. They left ranked militarily in ranks. It needed to happen that way. You got 2.5 million people. You need to have some kind of organization, not just a, you know, not just this meandering group of people wandering through stuff. But I think there was a plan there. Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Of course, it took a long time. Moses was dealing with the federal government.
Of course, federal government. Yeah, okay, we're not even going to give that one any kind of. So anyway, they're moving. It moves them away from Egypt, or away from the Philistines, so that they can not turn back easily. Again, it's not because by leading them the way he led them that they're going to be hunky-dory and fine and not want to go back. No, they're going to want to go back all the time. It's going to be a normal thing for them to say, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back. In fact, at one point, even a guy named Dothan even leads a rebellion against Moses. It doesn't go well for Dothan because a lot of them get swallowed up by the ground. But there is a desire to go back. But because God leads them south, away from the land of the Philistines, and away from the easy way, it gets hard for them to go back, and they don't just turn around and go home. They don't just turn around and go back to Egypt, because that's not where they're supposed to be. So he leads them away from the Philistines, but then he leads them with pillars. Leads them with pillars. He leads them with a pillar of cloud in the daytime and a pillar of fire at night. It's interesting, if you go to some of the more liberal scholars who try to explain away the miraculous, explain away the supernatural, there was actually one guy who suggested that this was a common phenomena in that area, where you'll have these dust clouds that form, and they look as if they're great pillars, and because of the electric activity, they'll get lightning and thunder and stuff like that. And maybe I don't think any of those last 40 years. I don't think you have a 40-year phenomenon. All right. It's just fun watching people try to explain away miraculous. It would be easier for them to say, yeah, it was miraculous. It was pretty amazing. But they've got this mindset that there can't be anything like that. So they try to offer these explanations. But then when you start poking holes in them, their explanations fall apart really, really quickly. But God leads them with these two pillars. Actually, it's one pillar that presents itself as a pillar of cloud at the daytime and a pillar of fire at night. It's always in front of Israel. It's always telling them where they need to be, except for one time. It gets behind them, and it gets between Egypt, the Egyptian army, and Israel getting ready to cross the Red Sea. That's the only time it gets behind them. Every other time it's in front of them, and he's leading them through this with his pillar of cloud and pillar of fire. There's no question. They have no question where it is they need to go. God's going to explain what this is, the pillar of cloud. When the pillar of cloud is going to stand, when it stands still, God's going to tell them in the future, when it stands still, put the tabernacle up. Put the tabernacle up, and you're going to stay here for a while. When it's moving, don't put the tabernacle up. You keep moving. Keep walking. You go where I want you to go. And so he leads them in a clear and definite way with the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire that he sets up for them. And that's in verse 22. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Didn't depart from before the people and didn't depart for 40 years. That's a miraculous, supernatural phenomenon. That's not something you can explain with some kind of a dust storm in that land. One of the things that also happens is Joseph's bones get taken out. There's a point back to Genesis. Just as Joseph is dying, he asks his brothers, make sure you carry my bones out of here. When God takes you out of here, take care of my bones and bury me in Canaan, where we're supposed to be. And so there's a hint back. They actually follow through with that, and they carry Joseph's bones out of the land. That's a little aside right there in, I think, verse 19. Yeah, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph made the sons of Israel solemnly swear. So that's going on there. Now we get to probably the big deal, the crossing the Red Sea, all right? That's in chapter 14 and 15, is crossing the Red Sea. What time is it? We can get started. First thing we see in crossing the Red Sea is going to be God's plans. God's plans. God knows what's going to happen. He's not caught off guard by this. It's not like, oh, no, now what do we do? No, remember, he is purposefully leading them in a direction that he's leading them. He's purposefully taking them the way he wants to take them, and it's not an accident. He is leading them away from the Philistines. He's leading them with his pillar of cloud, pillar of fire, exactly where he wants them to go. So he has a plan. Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of that word, between Migdol and the sea. I don't want to swear on Sunday morning. In front of Baal Ziphon, you shall encamp facing it by the sea. So God says, you go this place, you lead them here, and you stay. Now, Pharaoh, because of what's happened, you're Pharaoh, right? And you're watching these people leave. And you know where they're going. You know they're going from Egypt to Canaan. And you see Moses take them not the shortest route, but he takes them what's going to be a much longer route, takes them south. Not only that, it appears that they kind of get lost. It appears they're wandering, and the text, they're kind of wandering around. And Pharaoh thinks, aha, this is my chance. My chance to wreak havoc on them. I'm going to get them. But God has that plan. God has that plan, and he's working. So he actually instructs Moses, stop. Stop right here. And you encamp, but you encamp facing the sea. So don't face back to Egypt. You face the sea. That's where I want you to stop. So because he knows, God knows what's going to happen. In fact, he's playing a part in what's happening. What's he say? He says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and they did so. So God has a plan to, you would think that, you know, death of the firstborn, didn't he get glory there? But still Pharaoh thinks he's still something special. He thinks he's still smarter than or more powerful than God, and God has one more thing he needs to do to finally and completely show Pharaoh, no, you're not. Remember, the rescue of Egypt, of Israel from Egypt wasn't just about Israel. It was also about God showing himself who he is to the Egyptians. And he's done that. And there are a lot of, remember, there's that mixed multitude at the end of chapter 12 that come out with Israel. There's a large number of folks who recognize in Egypt who God is and are coming with him. But he wants to show himself to all of Egypt as God over even Pharaoh. So that's still his plan and still what he's working, and that's part of what the Red Sea crossing is all about. So they're in the place, they're waiting, God knows what he's going to do, and that's his plan. I think it's important to recognize this is not an accident. Sometimes when we read about the Red Sea, it's like, oh no, they're stuck. And, you know, and I think of, you know, the Ten Commandment movie does that for us. It wants us to feel that way. It wants us to feel like, oh, you know, they're going to die. But that was never the plan. It was not for them to die. It was always for God to show himself as God over all gods, God over Pharaoh, and to accomplish his final purpose for Egypt in crushing them the way he was going to crush them. So that's his plan. And I think there's a significant lesson for us in that. If we are truly following God and if he is truly leading us, then I think he's demonstrated throughout the New Testament that he has a plan for us, that where we are is no accident. Was it easy for Israel to be up against the Red Sea between the Egyptians and the Red Sea? Probably not easy at all. Was it part of God's plan for them to teach them what he wanted to teach them? Absolutely it is. And in fact, if you consider what happens at the Red Sea, Israel points back numerous times as their history lessons are given. They really point to the Red Sea crossing as a big time when they saw God faithfully preserve them and faithfully deliver them. The Red Sea crossing is a big deal for them, because they recognize this wasn't about anything they did. It was solely what God did for them. And so God needed to use this in their life. God needed to use this in Egypt's life. And sometimes God needs to use difficulties in our life to accomplish his purpose. And rather than throw our hands in the air and say, oh, why have you done this? Maybe it's a better idea to say, what are you doing? What are you teaching me? What do I need to learn through this difficulty, through this trial, Because sometimes if you mark those trials and you mark how God takes you through that trial, it's a really good way to look back and see the faithfulness of God in your generation and throughout all generations, how faithful he's been. And I think that's what part of what's going on here at the Red Sea is to show God does have a plan. And I think that's why he reveals that plan before they get there. He says, here's what's going to happen. He tells Moses, here's what's going to happen. I know this is going to happen. Pharaoh's going to pursue because I'm going to cause him to do it. I'm going to harden his heart. I'm going to be the one that pushes him to do this, and he's going to come after you. So those are Pharaoh's plan, or God's plans. What are Pharaoh's actions? What are Pharaoh's actions? Well, here we go. The king of Egypt was told that the people had fled. The mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people, and they said, what is this we have done? What is this we have done? We have let Israel go from serving us. So he recognizes, oh no, that was my labor force. What am I going to do? I can't do this. So not only is him, but some of his servants also say, what have you done? Why would his servants be worried about that? I love the fact that his servants say, what have we done? Who's going to be making bricks now? His servants are going to make bricks. Instead of doing the stuff they were doing, now it's going to be their job to make the bricks. Why do you think they want him to stop this thing? Well, because we don't want to make bricks. So let's go get him, Pharaoh. So he's going to go get them. He says, so he made ready his chariot, took his army with him, took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamped by the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. So that sets the stage for next week. next week. I think I'm here next week. That sets the stage for next week when we'll actually get into the Red Sea crossing. Now, where we are is they are encamped facing the sea, and the sea is not, we'll talk about this next time, that wherever you see them crossing, if you see it Red Sea or Reed Sea, which could be Red Sea, the whole, Ron wrote a little article about that, wherever you see them crossing, what you don't want to do is take away the miraculous, because even if it is the Reed Sea at that point in time where they crossed, it still is a miraculous crossing. It's a miraculous thing that happens. It can't be just a little stream that they got to cross. Here's why it can't be just a little stream they got to cross, because when the stream closes back down, it crushes Pharaoh's army. So it's big enough to do that, so it's a big deal. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that thing, but where they are right now is they're camped against this Red Sea, or this sea, this incrossable object, this insurmountable wall that's in front of them with a undefeatable force behind them, and they're sandwiched between those two. And it appears they're hopeless, except for the fact that now the pillar of cloud has moved away from in front of them and moved behind them and is standing between them and Pharaoh's armies. So God is protecting them. God is protecting them, and he's going to provide for them as they get across. So that's where they are. But it doesn't mean they're not scared to death. Doesn't mean they're not scared to death. In fact, they are scared to death, and they're going to respond in fear, and we'll talk about that next time. So that's where we'll stop. It's 9:45 now, so we'll stop there, and we'll pick up with letter C next time, Israel's something. I'm not going to give you the word, but that's it. Okay, you're dismissed. Thanks.